wisdom was not a monopoly held by mechanics and tradesmen. Though Hamilton often regarded the French allies as a royal nuisance, he never denied the decisive nature of their intervention. From the start, they had smuggled weapons and supplies to the Patriots. Many were also fine soldiers, and Hamilton later paid tribute to the ardent, impetuous, and military genius of the French. By the spring of 1779, he could say categorically of these sometimes trying allies, "Their friendship is the pillar of our security." The status-conscious Hamilton was also sensitive to perceived iniquities among Washington's staff, even when it pertained to his closest friend, John Laurens. In November 1778, just before Henry Laurens stepped down as its president, Congress tried to promote John Laurens to lieutenant colonel as a reward for valorous conduct. Laurens declined but accepted the offer when it was renewed in March 1779. Hamilton did not urge Laurens to reject the commission, but he was dismayed nonetheless. "The only thing I see wrong in the affair is this," Hamilton wrote to his friend. "Congress, by their conduct, appear to have intended to confer a privilege, an honor, a mark of distinction, which they withhold from other gentlemen in the military family. This carries with it an air of preference, which, though we can all truly say we love your character and admire your military merit, cannot fail to give some of us uneasy sensations." Hamilton and Laurens shared an idealism about the Revolution that yoked them tightly together. They were both unwavering abolitionists who saw emancipation of the slaves as an inseparable part of the struggle for freedom, as well as a source of badly needed manpower. "I think that we Americans, at least in the southern colonies, cannot contend with a good grace for liberty until we shall have enfranchised our slaves," Laurens told a friend right before the signing of the Declaration of Independence. This represented a courageous stand for the son of a very significant South Carolina slaveholder. From the time he joined Washington's family, Laurens unabashedly championed a plan in which slaves would earn their freedom by joining the Continental Army. About 5,000 blacks eventually did serve alongside the Patriots, though they were frequently relegated to non-combat situations. Short of soldiers, Rhode Island raised a black regiment in 1778 by promising slaves their freedom. Laurens offered more than lip service to his scheme, telling his father that he was willing to take his inheritance in the form of a black battalion, freed and equipped to defend South Carolina. At the end of the year, Laurens's proposal acquired increased urgency as the British redirected their military operations southward, hoping to rouse Loyalist sympathies. By January 1779, they had captured both Savannah and Augusta and threatened South Carolina. Laurens resigned from Washington's family and returned to defend his home state, stopping in Philadelphia to solicit congressional approval for 2 to 4 black battalions for the Continental Army. Hamilton drafted an eloquent, supportive letter for his friend to deliver to John Jay, who had succeeded Henry Laurens as president of Congress. In the letter, Hamilton plainly revealed what he thought of the slave system that had surrounded him since birth. "I have not the least doubt that the Negroes will make very excellent soldiers with proper management, and I will venture to pronounce that they cannot be put in better hands than those of Mr. Laurens." Hamilton brushed aside the fallacies that slaves were not smart enough to turn into soldiers and were genetically inferior. "This is so far from appearing to me a valid objection that I think their want of cultivation, for their natural faculties are probably as good as ours, joined to that habit of subordination which they acquire from a life of servitude, will make them sooner become soldiers than our white inhabitants." In a typical Hamiltonian manner, he placed political realism at the service of a larger ethical framework, stressing that both humanity and self-interest argued for the Laurens proposal. "The contempt we have been taught to entertain for the blacks makes us fancy many things that are founded neither in reason nor experience, and an unwillingness to part with property of so valuable a kind will furnish 1,000 arguments to show the impracticability or pernicious tendency of a scheme which requires such a sacrifice. But it should be considered that if we do not make use of them in this way, the enemy probably will, and that the best way to counteract the temptations they will hold out will be to offer them ourselves. An essential part of the plan is to give them their freedom with their muskets. This will secure their fidelity, animate their courage, and I believe will have a good influence upon those who remain by opening a door to their emancipation." Unfortunately, Lawrence's battle in the South Carolina legislature to enact his program proved futile. South Carolina had a special stake in the slave trade, with Charleston acting as the largest port of entry for slaves arriving in North America. As in many places, planters lived in dread of slave insurrections, constantly inspected slave quarters for concealed weapons, and sometimes themselves refused to serve in the Continental Army out of fear that in their absence their slaves might rise up and massacre their families. The northern states were not about to override their southern brethren on the slavery issue. All along, the American Revolution had been premised on a tacit bargain that regional conflicts would be subordinated to the need for unity among the states. This understanding dictated that slavery would remain a taboo subject. There was also the ticklish matter that many slave owners had joined the revolution precisely to retain slavery. In November 1775, Lord Dunmore, the royal governor of Virginia, had issued a proclamation offering freedom to slaves willing to defend the crown, an action that sent many panicky slaveholders stampeding into the Patriot camp. "How is it we hear the loudest yelps for liberty from the drivers of Negroes?" Samuel Johnson protested from London. Horace Walpole echoed this sentiment. "I should think the souls of the Africans would sit heavily on the swords of the Americans." Many on the Patriot side recognized the hypocrisy of the American position. Even before the Declaration of Independence, Abigail Adams had bewailed the situation. "It always appeared a most iniquitous scheme to me, to fight for ourselves for what we are robbing and plundering from those who have as good a right to freedom as we have." And yet, to the everlasting disgrace of the rebel colonists, it was General Sir Henry Clinton in June 1779 who promised freedom to runaway slaves defecting to the British side. The defeat of the Lawrence plan left Hamilton utterly dejected. "I wish its success," he wrote to Lawrence later in the year, "but my hopes are very feeble. Prejudice and private interest will be antagonists too powerful for public spirit and public good." After Lawrence despaired of securing legislative action on his proposal, he turned to military service in South Carolina under Brigadier General William Moultrie. He was so fearless yet foolhardy in one rearguard action. Without authority, he led his men across an exposed river position and suffered heavy casualties, that Moultrie later called Lawrence a young man of great merit and a brave soldier, but an imprudent officer. He was too rash and impetuous. A story, perhaps apocryphal, says that when the British subsequently besieged Moultrie and his men at Charleston, Lawrence vowed to run his sword through the first civilian who proposed surrendering the city and further refused to carry terms of capitulation to the enemy. During Lawrence's southern sojourn, Hamilton wrote to him some of the most personally revealing letters of his life. He knew the South was endangered by the British and that atrocities were being committed on both sides. Perhaps he wondered whether he would ever see his friend again. In one April 1779 letter, Hamilton expressed such open affection for Lawrence that an early editor, presumably Hamilton's son, crossed out some of the words and scrawled across the top, "I must not publish the whole of this." Besides fondness for Lawrence, the letter shows how much Hamilton, scarred by his past, was afraid to entrust his emotional security to anyone. "Cold in my professions, warm in friendships, I wish, my dear Lawrence, it might be in my power by action rather than words to convince you that I love you. I shall only tell you that till you bade us adieu, I hardly knew the value you had taught my heart to set upon you. Indeed, my friend, it was not well done. You know the opinion I entertain of mankind, and how much it is my desire to preserve myself free from particular attachments and to keep my happiness independent of the caprice of others. You should not have taken advantage of my sensibility to steal into my affections without my consent." Other letters that Hamilton wrote to Lawrence betray the tone of a jealous, lovesick young man who was quick to chide his friend for failing to write frequently enough. "I have written you 5 or 6 letters since you left Philadelphia, and I should have written you more had you made proper return," Hamilton wrote to Lawrence in September. "But, like a jealous lover, when I thought you slighted my caresses, my affection was alarmed and my vanity piqued." Many things beyond the absence of Lawrence troubled Hamilton that summer, especially the short-sighted failure of the states to grant mandatory taxing power to Congress in the Articles of Confederation, which had been approved as the new nation's governing charter on November 15, 1777, and submitted to the states for ratification. As a result, Congress had resorted to flimsy financial expedients, borrowing and printing reams of paper money that were fast destroying America's credit. The paper currency was depreciating rapidly. Hence, for the first time, Hamilton began to fiddle with ideas for creating a national bank through a mixture of foreign loans and private subscriptions. Hamilton may have been more vocal in his criticism of Congress than he realized. In early July, he received a letter from a Lieutenant Colonel John Brooks, who reported derogatory comments that Congressman Francis Dana made about Hamilton at a Philadelphia coffee house. According to Brooks, Dana quoted Hamilton as saying that it was high time for the people to rise, join General Washington, and turn Congress out of doors. To render this account in the highest degree improbable, he further observed that Mr. Hamilton could be no ways interested in the defense of this country, and therefore was most likely to pursue such a line of conduct as his great ambition dictated. These charges set an early pattern for future Hamilton controversies. People would assume that Hamilton, as an outsider or foreigner, could not possibly be motivated by patriotic impulses. Hence, he must be power-mad and governed by a secret agenda. In response, Hamilton would display a deep insecurity that he normally kept well hidden behind his confident demeanor. If struck, he tended to hit back hard. Within days, Hamilton wrote to Dana and demanded either a retraction of the story or disclosure of its source. He intimated that he would demand a duel if the charges had actually been made, noting that they are of so personal and illiberal a complexion as will oblige me to make them the subject of a very different kind of discussion from the present at some convenient season. After a lengthy correspondence, Hamilton traced the rumor back to a critic of Washington named William Gordon, a congressional minister in Jamaica Plains, Massachusetts. At first, Gordon pretended that he was merely repeating the story. He would name the source, he said, if Hamilton promised not to challenge him to a duel, a practice Gordon said he opposed on religious grounds. Even though Hamilton had served as a second for Lawrence in the Charles Lee duel and had hinted at his own readiness to duel in the current matter, he told Gordon, "It often happens that our zeal is at variance with our understanding. Had it not been for this, you might have recollected that we do not now live in the days of chivalry, and you would have judged your precautions, on the subject of dueling at least, useless. The good sense of the present times has happily found out that to prove your own innocence, or the malice of an accuser, the worst method you can take is to run him through the body or shoot him through the head. And permit me to add that while you felt an aversion to dueling on the principles of religion, you ought, in charity, to have supposed others possessed of the same scruples, of whose impiety you had no proofs." Aware that it clashed with his religious beliefs, Hamilton always retained some nagging reservations about dueling, which became more pronounced in later years. Hamilton never met Gordon on the field of honor, even though he did finally identify him as the source of the libel. Throughout the fall, he plied Gordon with combative letters, saying that he could not possibly have made the statements about Congress attributed to him. Yet Hamilton had been sniping at congressional ineptitude all year, and he may well have said something critical of Congress that was either misconstrued by his enemies or reported faithfully. That September, Hamilton sent Lawrence a letter that showed him steeped in inconsolable gloom. He told Lawrence that he still yearned for the success of his virtuous scheme for black battalions, but worried that private greed, indolence, and public corruption would undermine this good work. "Every hope of this kind, my friend, is an idle dream," he warned Lawrence in a despairing tone that was to crop up throughout his life. He added, "There is no virtue in America. That commerce which presided over the birth and education of these states has fitted their inhabitants for the chain, and the only condition they sincerely desire is that it may be a golden one." What a dark, weary view for a 24-year-old fighting for glorious ideals. It was to be a recurring paradox of Hamilton's career that he grew enraged when accused of being an outsider, and then sounded, in response, very much like the outsider evoked by his critics. The virulent charges made against him sometimes alienated him from his adopted country, leaving him feeling that perhaps his critics had a point after all. Chapter 7. The Lovesick Colonel. The American Revolution unfolded in a leisurely enough manner to allow Hamilton a fairly rich social life amid the grim necessities of war. With a young man's need for diversion, he continued to flirt with the fashionable ladies who stopped by Army headquarters. Not for nothing did Martha Washington nickname her large, lascivious tomcat, Hamilton, and they warmed to his high spirits, savoir-faire, and dancing ability. The Continental Army had a sizable following of camp ladies, and John Marshall was scandalized by the open debauchery that he encountered when visiting the Army that September. "Never was I a witness to such a scene of lewdness," he complained to a friend. Hamilton once told a friend that a soldier should have no wife other than the military, yet he began to contemplate marriage in the spring of 1779, following the alliance with France, which improved the prospects of growing American victory. He knew that once the war ended, he had no family. That April, Hamilton composed a long letter to John Laurens, outlining his requirements for a wife. Probably from childhood experience, he thought that most marriages were unhappy, and he dreaded making the wrong choice. Parts of his letter were sophomoric, with Hamilton making bawdy references to the size of his nose, jocular 18th-century shorthand for his penis, but much of it was thoughtful, showing that Hamilton had given serious consideration to the elements of a stable marriage. "She must be young, handsome, I lay most stress upon a good shape, sensible, a little learning will do, well-bred, but she must have an aversion to the word ton, chaste and tender, I am an enthusiast in my notions of fidelity and fondness, of some good nature, a great deal of generosity. She must neither love money nor scolding, for I dislike equally a termagant and an economist. In politics, I am indifferent what side she may be of. I think I have arguments that will easily convert her to mine. As to religion, a moderate streak will satisfy me. She must believe in God and hate a saint. But as to fortune, the larger stock of that, the better. You know my temper and circumstances, and will therefore pay special attention to this article in the treaty. Though I run no risk of going to purgatory for my avarice, yet as money is an essential ingredient to happiness in this world, as I have not much of my own, and as I am very little calculated to get more either by my address or industry, it must needs be that my wife, if I get one, bring at least a sufficiency to administer to her own extravagancies." In describing his ideal wife, Hamilton sketches something of a self-portrait as he tries to strike a balance between worldliness and morality. He frankly admits to a desire for money, yet is not a slave to greed. A believer in conventional morality and marital fidelity, he nevertheless hates a prig. He likes religion in moderation. Clearly he dislikes fanaticism and sanctimony. And instead of a sex goddess or a nubile coquette, types that had always titillated him, he opts for a solid, sensible, reasonably attractive wife. When Washington took his troops to winter headquarters at Morristown that December, Hamilton had extra time to dwell on his future plans. Washington and his staff occupied the mansion of the late Judge Jacob Ford, a stately white house with green trim. Hamilton worked in a log office annexed to the mansion and slept in an upstairs bedroom with Tench Tillman and James McHenry. The elements conspired against the Continental Army that winter, said to be the most frigid of the century. In New York Bay, the ice froze so thick that the British Army was able to wheel heavy artillery across it. 28 snowstorms pounded the Morristown headquarters, including a January blizzard that lasted 3 days, piling snow in 6-foot-high banks. For Washington, it was the war's nadir, a winter even more depressing than the one at Valley Forge. The snowstorms shut off roads and blocked provisions, leading to looting among troops freezing in log huts. Men mutinied and deserted in large numbers. On January 5, 1780, Washington sent Congress a dreary account. "Many of the men have been 4 or 5 days without meat entirely and short of bread, and none but on very scanty supplies. Some, for their preservation, have been compelled to maraud and rob from the inhabitants, and I have it not in my power to punish or repress the practice." These problems were compounded by the structural inability of Congress to tax the states or establish public credit. The memories of Valley Forge and Morristown would powerfully affect the future political agendas of both Washington and Hamilton, who had to grapple with the defects of a weak central government. In January, when Washington did not allow Hamilton to join Lawrence for a combat command in the South, Hamilton tumbled into the darkness of depression. "I am chagrined and unhappy, but I submit," he wrote to Lawrence. "In short, Lawrence, I am disgusted with everything in this world but yourself and very few more honest fellows, and I have no other wish than as soon as possible to make a brilliant exit. 'Tis a weakness, but I feel I am not fit for this terrestrial country." It was not the first time that Hamilton had glancingly alluded to suicide or emigration, or suggested that he was miscast on the American scene. Salvation, it turned out, was at hand, as the Morristown winter proved unexpectedly sociable. The Marquis de Chasteloup remembered one convivial dinner with George Washington, at which the lively Hamilton doled out food, refilled glasses, and proposed gallant toasts. Sleighing parties full of pretty young women succeeded in crossing the snowdrifts to attend receptions. Hamilton subscribed to dancing assemblies, fancy dress balls attended by chief officers, held at a nearby storehouse. Washington, in a black velvet suit, danced and cut a dashing figure with the ladies, while Steuben flashed with medals, and French officers glistened with gold braid and lace. In this anomalous setting, the women courted these revolutionaries in powdered hair and high heels. To the vast amusement of Washington's family, Hamilton was infatuated that January with a young woman named Cornelia Lott. Colonel Samuel B. Webb even wrote a humorous verse mocking how the young conqueror had himself been conquered. "Now Hamilton feels the inexorable dart and yields Cornelia all his heart." The fickle Hamilton soon moved on to a young woman named Polly. On February 2, 1780, hard on the heels of Cornelia and Polly, Elizabeth Schuyler arrived in Morristown, accompanied by a military escort, to stay with relatives. She carried introductory letters to Washington and Steuben, one of the most gallant men in the camp, from her father, General Philip Schuyler. The general's sister, Gertrude, had married a well-established physician, Dr. John Cochran, who had moved to New Brunswick, New Jersey, to have a safe, pleasant spot to inoculate people against smallpox. Not only was Cochran an excellent doctor, he also traveled with the army as Washington's personal physician, and Lafayette had dubbed him Good Dr. Bones, but he was later appointed Director General of the Army's Medical Department. During the winter encampment at Morristown, Cochran and his wife stayed at the neat white house of their friend, Dr. Jabez Campfield, a quarter mile down the road from Washington's headquarters. So Schuyler found herself in close proximity to her future husband. Hamilton's place on Washington's staff enabled him to socialize with Eliza Schuyler on equal terms. He had already met her on his flying visit to Albany in 1777, when he coaxed General Horatio Gates into surrendering troops to Washington. Even without this prior meeting, Hamilton would have met Eliza because she came with their mutual friend, Kitty Livingston, long a favorite object of flirtation with Hamilton. Hamilton, 25, was instantly smitten with Schuyler, 22. Fellow aide Tench Tillman reported, "Hamilton is a gone man." Pretty soon, Hamilton was a constant visitor at the two-story Campfield residence, spending every evening there. Everyone noticed that the young colonel was starry-eyed and distracted. Although a touch absent-minded, Hamilton ordinarily had a faultless memory, but returning from Schuyler one night, he forgot the password and was barred by the sentinel. "The soldier lover was embarrassed," recalled Gabriel Ford, then 14, the son of Judge Ford. "The sentinel knew him well, but was stern in the performance of his duty. Hamilton pressed his hand to his forehead and tried to summon the important words from their hiding place, but, like the faithful sentinel, they were immovable." Ford took pity on Hamilton and supplied the password. By the time Hamilton left Morristown in early March to negotiate a prisoner exchange with the British in Amboy, New Jersey, scarcely more than a month after the courtship began, he and Schuyler had decided to wed. Hamilton must have been struck by the coincidence that his paternal grandfather, Alexander Hamilton, had also married an Elizabeth who was the daughter of a rich, illustrious man. For Hamilton, Eliza formed part of a beautiful package labeled the Schuyler family, and he spared no effort over time to ingratiate himself with the three sons, John Bradstreet, Philip Jeremiah, and Rensselaer, and five daughters, Angelica, Eliza, Margarita, Cornelia, and the as-yet-unborn Catherine. The daughters in particular, all smart, beautiful, gregarious, and rich, must have been the stuff of fantasy for Hamilton. Each played a different musical instrument, and they collectively charmed and delighted all visitors to the Schuyler Mansion in Albany. After spending a week with the family in April 1776, Benjamin Franklin expressed pleasure with the ease and affability with which we were treated and the lively behavior of the young ladies. Tench Tillman was likewise captivated. "There is something in the behavior of the general, his lady, and daughters that makes one acquainted with them instantly. I feel easy and free from restraint at his seat." The daughters had enough spunky independence that four of the five eventually eloped, Eliza being the significant exception. Cornelia enacted the most colorful escape, later stealing off with a young man named Washington Morton by climbing down a rope ladder from her bedroom and fleeing in a waiting coach. With fairy tale suddenness, the orphaned Hamilton had annexed a gigantic and prosperous clan. After seeing pictures of Eliza's younger sister Margarita, always called Peggy, he sent her a long, rambling letter in which he poured out his love for her older sister. "I venture to tell you in confidence that by some odd contrivance or other, your sister has found out the secret of interesting me in everything that concerns her. She is most unmercifully handsome and so perverse that she has none of those pretty affectations which are the prerogatives of beauty. Her good sense is destitute of that happy mixture of vanity and ostentation which would make it conspicuous to the whole tribe of fools and foplings. She has good nature, affability, and vivacity, unembellished with that charming frivolousness which is justly deemed one of the principal accomplishments of a belle. In short, she is so strange a creature that she possesses all the beauties, virtues, and graces of her sex, without any of those amiable defects which are esteemed by connoisseurs necessary shades in the character of a fine woman." In this letter, Hamilton endows Schuyler with traits exactly consistent with the list he had prepared for John Laurens 10 months earlier. She was handsome, sensible, good-natured, and free from vanity or affectation. And since she was the daughter of one of New York's wealthiest, most powerful men, Hamilton would not have to choose between love and money. Born on August 9, 1757, Elizabeth Schuyler, whom Hamilton called either Eliza or Betsy, remains invisible in most biographies of her husband and was certainly the most self-effacing founding mother, doing everything in her power to focus the spotlight exclusively on her husband. Her absence from the pantheon of early American figures is unfortunate, since she was a woman of sterling character. Beneath an animated, engaging facade, she was loyal, generous, compassionate, strong-willed, funny, and courageous. Short and pretty, she was utterly devoid of conceit and was to prove an ideal companion for Hamilton, lending a strong home foundation to his turbulent life. His letters to her reflected not a single moment of pique, irritation, or disappointment. Everybody sang Eliza's praises. "A brunette with the most good-natured, lively dark eyes that I ever saw, which threw a beam of good temper and benevolence over her whole countenance," Tench Tillman wrote in his journal. She was no pampered heiress. An athletic woman and a stout walker, she moved with a determined spring in her step. On one picnic excursion, Tillman watched her laughingly clamber up a steep hillside while less plucky girls required male assistance. The Marquis de Chastellux liked her mild, agreeable countenance, while Brissot de Warville credited her with being a delightful woman who combines both the charms and attractions and the candor and simplicity typical of American womanhood. Like others, James McHenry sensed intense passion throbbing beneath her restraint. She could be impulsive. Hers was a strong character with its depth and warmth, whether of feeling or temper controlled, but glowing underneath, bursting through at times in some emphatic expression. In 1787, Ralph Earle painted a perceptive portrait of Eliza Hamilton. It shows her with strikingly alert black eyes, the feature that most attracted Hamilton, that glowed with inner strength. She flaunts one of the powdered bouffant hairdos so popular among society women at the time, what one of her friends called her Marie Antoinette coiffure. Her gaze is frank and open, as if she were ready to chat amiably with the viewer. Beneath her white silk taffeta dress, she has a shapely body but not a delicate femininity. Her makeup is so understated as to be scarcely noticeable. She seems robust and energetic, and one can imagine her having been a tomboy. All in all, she seems a cheerful, modest soul, blessed with gumption. Schuyler's unassuming character is plain in her own admiring description of Martha Washington, whom she met at Morristown that winter. She received us so kindly, kissing us both, for the General and Papa were very warm friends. She was then nearly 50 years old, but was still handsome. She was quite short, a plump little woman with dark brown eyes, her hair a little frosty, and very plainly dressed for such a grand lady as I considered her. She wore a plain brown gown of homespun stuff, a large white handkerchief, a neat cap, and her plain gold wedding ring, which she had worn for more than 20 years. She was always my ideal of a true woman. As soon as Schuyler arrived in Morristown, she gave Martha Washington a pair of cuffs as a gift, and the latter reciprocated with some powder. In time, the relationship between Schuyler and the older woman ripened into something akin to a mother-daughter relationship. Schuyler had received some tutoring, but little formal schooling. Her spelling was poor, and she did not write with the fluency of other Schuylers. One does not imagine her dipping into Hume or Hobbes or the weighty philosophers regularly consulted by her husband. On the other hand, as the daughter of a soldier and statesman, she was well versed in public affairs and had been exposed to many political luminaries. At 13, she accompanied her father to a conclave of chiefs of the Six Nations at Saratoga and received an Indian name meaning one of us. She had been taught backgammon by none other than Ben Franklin in April 1776, when he visited General Schuyler en route to his diplomatic mission to Canada. Like Hamilton, Eliza was avidly interested in the world around her. One intriguing question about Eliza Schuyler and Alexander Hamilton concerns their religious beliefs. An active member of the Dutch Reformed Church, Schuyler was a woman of such indomitable Christian faith that Tench Tillman called her the little saint in one letter. Washington's staff was slightly taken aback that the rakish Hamilton chose this pious wife. Hamilton had been devout when younger, but he seemed more skeptical about organized religion during the Revolution. Soon after meeting Schuyler, he wrote a letter of recommendation for a military parson, Dr. Mendy. "He is just what I should like for a military parson, except that he does not whore or drink," Hamilton said. "He will fight, and he will not insist upon your going to heaven, whether you will or not." Eliza never doubted her husband's faith, and always treasured his sonnet, "A Soul Ascending into Bliss," written on St. Croix. On the other hand, Hamilton refrained from a formal church affiliation despite his wife's steadfast religiosity. Hamilton wooed Schuyler that winter with all the verbal resources at his disposal. He even composed a romantic sonnet entitled "Answer to the Inquiry Why I Sighed." Its couplets included these lines: "Before no mortal ever knew a love like mine so tender, true. No joy unmixed my bosom warms, but when my angel's in my arms." Though Schuyler knew that Hamilton was a figure of awesome intelligence, he won her more with his kindly nature than with his intellect. She was to recollect fondly one of his favorite sayings, "My dear Eliza, I have a good head, but thank God he has given me a good heart." In later years, when harvesting anecdotes about her husband, Eliza Hamilton gave correspondents a list of his qualities that she wanted to illustrate, and it sums up her view of his multiple talents: elasticity of his mind, variety of his knowledge, playfulness of his wit, excellence of his heart, his immense forbearance and virtues. When he wrote to John Laurens on March 30, 1780, Hamilton neglected to mention either Schuyler or his abrupt decision to marry her, a curious lack of candor. Then on June 30, he broke down and confessed all to his friend. "I give up my liberty to Miss Schuyler. She is a good-hearted girl who, I am sure, will never play the termagant. Though not a genius, she has good sense enough to be agreeable, and though not a beauty, she has fine black eyes, is rather handsome, and has every other requisite of the exterior to make a lover happy." Hamilton knew that he sounded less than enraptured, and that Laurens might suspect him of marrying Schuyler for her money, so he continued, "And believe me, I am a lover in earnest, though I do not speak of the perfections of my mistress in the enthusiasm of chivalry." Lest Laurens experience a jealous pang, Hamilton added a few months later, "In spite of Schuyler's black eyes, I have still a part for the public and another for you." And he promised he would be no less devoted to his friend after marriage than before. Hamilton delighted in the company of all the Schuyler sisters. Eliza's younger sister Peggy was very beautiful, but vain and supercilious. She married Stephen Van Rensselaer, 6 years her junior, the eighth patroon of Rensselaerwick and the largest landowner in New York State. Starting with that first winter in Morristown, Hamilton was drawn almost magnetically to Eliza's married older sister Angelica, and spent the rest of his life beguiled by both Eliza and Angelica, calling them my dear brunettes. Together, the two eldest sisters formed a composite portrait of Hamilton's ideal woman, each appealing to a different facet of his personality. Eliza reflected Hamilton's earnest sense of purpose, determination, and moral rectitude, while Angelica exhibited his worldly side, the wit, charm, and vivacity that so delighted people in social intercourse. The attraction between Hamilton and Angelica was so potent and obvious that many people assumed they were lovers. At the very least, theirs was a friendship of unusual ardor, and it seems plausible that Hamilton would have proposed to Angelica, not Eliza, if the older sister had been eligible. Angelica was more Hamilton's counterpart than Eliza. James McHenry once wrote to Hamilton that Angelica charms in all companies. No one has seen her, of either sex, who has not been pleased with her, and she pleased everyone, chiefly by means of those qualities which made you the husband of her sister. John Trumbull's portrait of Angelica shows a fetching woman with a long, pale face, dark eyes, and a pretty, full-lipped mouth, who is voguishly dressed and looks more sophisticated than Eliza. Angelica had a more mysterious femininity than her sister, the kind that often exerts a powerful hold on the male imagination. A playful seductress, she loved to engage in repartee, discuss books, strum the guitar, and talk about current affairs. She was to serve as muse to some of the smartest politicians of her day, including Thomas Jefferson, Robert R. Livingston, and most of all, Hamilton. Angelica was one of the few American women of her generation as comfortable in a European drawing room as in a Hudson River parlor, and there was a gossipy irreverence about her that seemed very European. Unlike Eliza, she learned to speak perfect French. Where Eliza bowed reluctantly to the social demands of Hamilton's career, Angelica applauded his ambitions and was always famished for news of his latest political exploits. For the next 24 years, Angelica expressed open fondness for Hamilton in virtually every letter that she sent to her sister or to Hamilton himself. Hamilton always wrote to her in a buoyant, flirtatious tone. Especially as his mind grew burdened with affairs of state, Angelica provided an outlet for his boyish side. To Eliza he wrote tenderly and lovingly, but seldom in the arch voice of gallantry. It is hard to escape the impression that Hamilton's married life was sometimes a curious menage a trois with two sisters who were only 1 year apart. Angelica must have sensed that her incessant adoration of Hamilton, far from annoying or threatening her beloved younger sister, filled her with ecstatic pride. Their shared love for Hamilton seemed to deepen their sisterly bond. Ironically, Eliza's special attachment to Angelica gave Hamilton a cover for expressing affection for Angelica that would certainly have been forbidden with other women. For a daring woman drawn to intellectual men, Angelica made a strange choice in marrying John Barker Church, a short man with shining eyes and thick lips who only grew fatter with the years. In 1776, he had been sent to Albany by Congress to audit the books of the Army's Northern Department, then commanded by General Schuyler. While there, he managed both to woo Angelica and antagonize her father. John B. Church was then using the pseudonym of John B. Carter, and Schuyler scented something suspicious. Schuyler's instincts proved correct. Church had changed his name and fled to America, possibly after a duel with a Tory politician in London. Some accounts have him on the lam from creditors after a bankruptcy brought on by gambling and stock speculation. Knowing that he would be denied parental consent, Church eloped with Angelica in 1777, and the Schuylers were predictably incensed. Church amassed fantastic wealth during the Revolution. "Mr. Carter is the mere man of business," James McHenry told Hamilton, "and I am informed has riches enough, with common management, to make the longest life comfortable." He and his business partner, Jeremiah Wadsworth, negotiated lucrative contracts to sell supplies to the French and American forces. Hamilton spoke highly of Church as a man of fortune and integrity, of strong mind, very exact, very active, and very much a man of business. Yet Church's letters present a cold businessman, devoid of warmth or humor. Very involved in politics, he could be tactless in expressing his opinions. One observer remembered him as revengeful and false after General Howe burned several American villages and towns. Church said he wanted to cut off the heads of the British generals and to pickle them and to put them in small barrels, and as often as the English should again burn a village, to send them one of these barrels. He lacked the intellectual breadth and civic commitment that made Hamilton so compelling to Angelica. On the other hand, he provided Angelica with the opulent, high society life that she apparently craved. Hamilton's relationship with his father-in-law was to be an especially happy part of his marriage to Eliza Schuyler. Tall and slim, with a raspy voice and bulbous nose, Philip Schuyler, 46, was already hobbled by rheumatic gout when he arrived in Morristown that April to investigate army reform as chairman of a congressional committee. It is testimony to Hamilton's gifts that he was readily embraced by someone with Schuyler's rigid sense of social hierarchy. "Be indulgent, my child, to your inferiors," Schuyler once advised his son John. "Affable and courteous to your equals, respectful, not cringing to your superiors, whether they are so by superior mental abilities or those necessary distinctions which society has established." Yet this same status-conscious man enjoyed an instant rapport with the illegitimate young West Indian. Both Hamilton and Schuyler spoke French, were well-read, appreciated military discipline, and had a common interest in business and internal development schemes, such as canals. They also shared a common loyalty to Washington and impatience with congressional incompetence, even though Schuyler was a member of the Continental Congress. Descended from an early Dutch settler who arrived in New York in 1650, the surname may have been German, Schuyler was counted among those Hudson River squires who presided over huge tracts of land and ruled state politics. The Schuylers had intermarried with the families of many patroons or manor lords. Philip Schuyler's mother was a Van Cortlandt. His elegant Georgian brick mansion, the Pastures, sat on an Albany hilltop, surrounded by 80 acres dotted with barns, slave quarters, and a smokehouse. The enterprising Schuyler also built a two-story house on the fringe of the Saratoga wilderness, where he created an industrial village with four water power mills, a smithy, and storehouses that employed hundreds of people. It evolved into the village of Schuylerville. In all, this Schuyler estate extended for 3 miles along the Hudson, encompassing somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000 acres. As if this were not enough, Philip Schuyler had married Catherine Van Rensselaer, an heiress to the 120,000-acre Claverick estate in Columbia County. The image of Philip Schuyler varied drastically depending upon the observer. His enemies viewed him as cold, arrogant, and petulant when people crossed him or when his pride was offended. Alexander Graydon left this unpleasant vignette of a Schuyler dinner during the Revolution. "A New England captain came in upon some business with that abject servility of manner which belongs to persons of the meanest rank. He was neither asked to sit or take a glass of wine, and after announcing his wants, was dismissed with that peevishness of tone we apply to a low and vexatious intruder." Graydon admitted, however, that the man might have forced his way into Schuyler's presence. Schuyler's friends, in contrast, found him courteous and debonair, a model of etiquette, and very amiable in mixed company. He could behave magnanimously toward his social peers. During the Battle of Saratoga, General Burgoyne burned Schuyler's house and most other buildings on his property for military reasons. When, after the surrender, Burgoyne apologized, Schuyler replied graciously that his conduct had been justified by the rules of war and that he would have done the same in his place. Baroness Riedesel, the wife of the Hessian commander Major General Friedrich von Riedesel, also recalled Schuyler's chivalry after the Saratoga debacle. "When I drew near the tents, a good-looking man advanced towards me and helped the children from the calash and kissed and caressed them. He then offered me his arm, and tears trembled in his eyes." Schuyler invited the Baroness, the defeated Burgoyne, and his 20-member entourage to stay in his Albany mansion and furnished them with excellent dinners for days. At the time, Schuyler did not yet realize that Burgoyne's destruction of his Saratoga estate had dealt a crippling blow to his finances. Hamilton knew that Schuyler could be a strict father to his sometimes rambunctious daughters, and that John Barker Church had been ostracized for not obeying protocol in marrying Angelica. So while Hamilton negotiated a prisoner exchange, he patiently awaited the Schuylers' consent for their daughter's hand. In the meantime, he relished Eliza's letters. I cannot tell you what ecstasy I felt in casting my eye over the sweet effusions of tenderness it contains, he said of one mid-March letter. My Betsy's soul speaks in every line and bids me be the happiest of mortals. I am so and will be so. On April 8, 1780, Philip Schuyler sent Hamilton a businesslike letter, saying he had discussed the marriage proposal with Mrs. Schuyler and they had accepted it. Hamilton was overjoyed. A few days later, he wrote to Mrs. Schuyler and thanked her for accepting his proposal, making sure to lay on the flattery with a trowel. May I hope, madam, you will not consider it as a mere profession when I add that, though I have not the happiness of a personal acquaintance with you, I am no stranger to the qualities which distinguish your character, and these make the relation in which I stand to you not one of the least pleasing circumstances of my union with your daughter. General Schuyler had taken a temporary house in Morristown and brought down Mrs. Schuyler from Albany. They stayed until the Continental Army decamped in June. Hamilton visited the Schuylers each evening, and the mutual affection between him and the family waxed steadily. In the end, the Schuylers felt flattered that the ex-clerk from the West Indies had chosen them. 2 years later, Philip Schuyler sent Eliza a delighted report on her amazing husband. Participate afresh in the satisfaction I experience from the connection you have made with my beloved Hamilton. He affords me a happiness too exquisite for expression. I daily experience the pleasure of hearing encomiums on his virtue and abilities from those who are capable of distinguishing between real and pretended merit. He is considered, as he certainly is, the ornament of his country. The marriage to Eliza Schuyler was another dreamlike turn in the improbable odyssey of Alexander Hamilton, giving him the political support of one of New York's blue ribbon families. Thoughts of both love and money coursed through Hamilton's brain during that Arctic winter in Morristown. The paper currency issued by the Continental Congress continued to sink precipitously in value as inflation undercut the patriotic cause. During one ghastly period in 1779, the Continental dollar shed half its value in 3 weeks. Silver coins disappeared, driven out by nearly worthless paper money, and state governments were also going broke. In March 1780, Congress tried to restore monetary order by issuing one new dollar in exchange for 40 old ones, a move that wiped out the savings of many Americans. The need for financial reform had grown urgent. James Madison worried in a letter to Thomas Jefferson, "Believe me, sir, as things now stand, if the states do not vigorously proceed in collecting the old money and establishing funds for the credit of the new, we are undone." In his spare time, Hamilton pored over financial treatises. As Washington's aide, he was not at liberty to issue controversial plans that might jeopardize congressional relations, so he drafted a clandestine letter to an unidentified congressman and outlined a new currency regime. "The present plan," he started humbly, "is the product of some reading on the subjects of commerce and finance, but a want of leisure has prevented its being examined in so many lights and digested so maturely as its importance requires." If the recipient wished further explanation, Hamilton indicated that a letter directed to James Montague, Esquire, lodged in the post office at Morristown, will be a safe channel for any communications you may think proper to make, and an immediate answer will be given. James Montague may have been a name devised by Hamilton to cloak his own identity. Hamilton's 6,000-word letter attests to staggering precocity. He saw that inflation had originated with wartime shortages, which had led, in turn, to the waning value of money. Over time, the inflation had acquired a self-reinforcing momentum. Economic fundamentals alone could not account for this inflation, Hamilton noted, detecting a critical psychological factor at work. People were governed more by passion and prejudice than by an enlightened sense of their interests, he wrote. The quantity of money in circulation is certainly a chief cause of its decline. But we find it is depreciated more than 5 times as much as it ought to be. The excess is derived from opinion, a want of confidence. How to remedy this want of confidence? Hamilton submitted a 12-point program, a fully realized vision of a financial system that reflected sustained thinking. Congress should create a central bank, owned half by the government and half by private individuals, that could issue money and make public and private loans. Drawing on European precedents, Hamilton cited the Bank of England and the French Council of Commerce as possible models. Taxes and domestic loans could not finance the war alone, he argued, and he pressed for a foreign loan of £2 million as the centerpiece of his program. The necessity of a foreign loan is now greater than ever. Nothing else will retrieve our affairs. He recognized that French and British political power stemmed from those countries' ability to raise foreign loans in wartime, and this inextricable linkage between military and financial strength informed all of his subsequent thinking. For Hamilton, the American Revolution was a practical workshop of economic and political theory, providing critical object lessons and cautionary tales that charted the course for his career. In May 1780, he had fresh cause to meditate on the failings of Congress when news came of a calamitous defeat. The British had taken Charleston, capturing an American garrison of 5,400 soldiers, including John Laurens. 1780 was to be a dismal year for the Patriots. In August, Cornwallis inflicted a stinging loss on General Horatio Gates in Camden, South Carolina, killing 900 Americans and taking 1,000 prisoners. For Hamilton, the terrible drubbings at Charleston and Camden drove home the need for longer enlistment periods and an end to reliance on state militia. He found some consolation in the fact that Gates had fled from Camden in terror, barely containing his glee at this sign of cowardice. Was there ever an instance of a general running away, as Gates has done, from his whole army? He gloated to New York Congressman James Duane. 180 miles in 3 days and a half. It does admirable credit to the activity of a man at his time of life. By October, General Nathaniel Greene replaced the disgraced Gates as commander of the Southern Army. To the setbacks in South Carolina, Hamilton reacted with stoic resignation as well as schadenfreude. "This misfortune affects me less than others," he told Eliza Schuyler, "because it is not in my temper to repine at evils that are past, but to endeavor to draw good out of them, and because I think our safety depends on a total change of system. And this change of system will only be produced by misfortune." He did not mention that he had just rushed off a 7,000-word letter to James Duane that showed that the future American government was already fermenting in his hyperactive brain. He now subjected the Articles of Confederation to a searching critique. He thought the sovereignty of the states only enfeebled the Union. "The fundamental defect is a want of power in Congress," he declared. He favored granting Congress supreme power in war, peace, trade, finance, and foreign affairs. Instead of bickering congressional boards, he wanted strong executives and endorsed single ministers for war, foreign affairs, finance, and the Navy. "There is always more decision, more dispatch, more secrecy, more responsibility where single men than when bodies are concerned. By a plan of this kind, we should blend the advantages of a monarchy and of a republic in a happy and beneficial union." Hamilton was especially intent upon subjecting all military forces to centralized congressional control. "Without a speedy change, the army must dissolve. It is now a mob rather than an army, without clothing, without pay, without provision, without morals, without discipline." Then, in the most startling, visionary leap of all, Hamilton recommended that a convention be summoned to revise the Articles of Confederation. 7 years before the Constitutional Convention, Alexander Hamilton became the first person to propose such a plenary gathering. Where other minds groped in the fog of war, the 25-year-old Hamilton seemed to perceive everything in a sudden flash. At the end of the letter, Hamilton apologized to Duane for having written down his ideas so hastily. The wonder, of course, is that he had recorded them at all. In mid-July, a French fleet had arrived off Newport, Rhode Island, with an army of 5,500 men commanded by the short, stocky Comte de Rochambeau. This was the French army that Hamilton had suggested to Lafayette as necessary to the war effort, and that Lafayette had successfully urged at Versailles. As soon as the French arrived, Hamilton was worn down with tremendous duties. Before meeting with Rochambeau at Hartford in late September, Washington asked his aide-de-camp to draw up three scenarios for joint military operations with the French. Hamilton must have been exhausted as he scratched out his long letter to Duane by candlelight at day's end. One might have thought that Hamilton, despite all the military uncertainty, would feel hopeful about his life. He was effectively Washington's chief of staff, was soon to be married to Elizabeth Schuyler, and was drafting high-level strategy papers and comprehensive blueprints for government. Yet underneath his high spirits still lurked the pessimism from his West Indian boyhood, and he sometimes viewed the world with a jaundiced, even misanthropic eye. Perhaps too much had happened too soon, and it had all been disorienting. He was critical of his compatriots. "My dear Lawrence," he had written to his friend that spring, "our countrymen have all the folly of the ass and all the passiveness of the sheep in their compositions." As he became more outspoken in his views, he discovered his own capacity for making enemies. On September 12th, he told Lawrence that everybody was angry with him. Some people thought he was a friend to military pretensions, however exorbitant, while others chided him for not being militant enough in defending army power. "The truth is, I am an unlucky, honest man that speaks my sentiments to all and with emphasis. I say this to you because you know it and will not charge me with vanity. I hate Congress. I hate the army. I hate the world. I hate myself. The whole is a mass of fools and knaves. I could almost accept you and Richard Kidder Meade. Adieu. A. Hamilton." Throughout his career, Hamilton had a knack for being present at historic moments. In September 1780, he was eyewitness to the treachery of General Benedict Arnold. Born in Norwich, Connecticut, Arnold had started out as a druggist and bookseller and expanded into speculative business ventures. A brave soldier and a student of military history, Arnold had distinguished himself in numerous clashes with the British and was wounded by a musket ball in the winter assault on Quebec. He fought so lustily at Saratoga, where he was injured again, that Hamilton and others had hailed him as the true, unacknowledged hero of the victory. As military governor of Philadelphia during the Patriot occupation, however, Arnold was harried by charges of corruption, which he indignantly dismissed as false, malicious, and scandalous. He was exonerated of all but two minor charges by a court-martial and got off with a reprimand from Washington. Yet by this point, the embittered Arnold, increasingly dubious about American prospects, had decided to engage in treason, relaying secret information about troop movements to the British. After being named the new commandant of West Point, he colluded to deliver plans of the fortifications to the British, making the stronghold vulnerable to attack. In exchange, Arnold was promised money and a high-level appointment in the British Army. Arnold took up his West Point command during the summer of 1780 and let its defenses fall into disrepair. On the morning of September 25th, Washington and a retinue that included Hamilton and Lafayette were passing through the Hudson Valley as they returned from the conference in Hartford with the Comte de Rochambeau. They planned to see Arnold and inspect West Point. Hamilton and James McHenry were sent ahead to prepare for Washington's reception at Arnold's headquarters in the Beverly Robinson House, a couple of miles downriver from West Point, on the east bank of the Hudson. During breakfast with the two aides, a flustered Arnold received a message indicating that a spy known as John Anderson had been seized north of New York City with descriptions of West Point's defenses tucked into his boot. Hamilton and McHenry were perplexed by Arnold's sudden agitation. Aghast that his plot had been foiled, Arnold raced upstairs to say goodbye to his wife, then slipped out of the house, hopped onto a barge, and fled downriver toward the British warship Vulture. Not long after, Washington showed up with his officers, noted Arnold's absence with puzzlement, had breakfast, then rode across the Hudson for his West Point tour. Hamilton stayed behind to sort through dispatches and was unnerved by intermittent shrieks from Mrs. Arnold upstairs. When Arnold's aide, Richard Varick, went up to investigate, he found her in a gauzy morning gown with disheveled hair. "Colonel Varick," the distraught woman demanded, "have you ordered my child to be killed?" She then babbled on incoherently about hot irons being placed on her head. 20 years younger than her husband, Margaret Peggy Shippen came from a Tory family in Philadelphia and had married Benedict Arnold at age 18 the year before. She was a petite, ringleted blonde with small features and large social ambitions. When Hamilton went upstairs, he found her clutching her baby and accusing everyone in sight of wanting to murder her child. Late in the afternoon, Washington returned to the house, befuddled by Arnold's absence from West Point and its negligent defenses. Hamilton gave Washington a thick packet of dispatches, including papers discovered on the captured John Anderson. Hamilton then went off to confer with Lafayette. When the two young men returned, they found their usually